Greetings, this is Robert Noya, Editor-in-Chief of Sky and Telescope Magazine. I'm on the phone with Dr. Michael Rich, Professor of Astronomy at UCLA. Dr. Rich is the author of the feature article about NASA's GALAX mission that appears in our April 2012 issue. Dr. Rich, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, you wrote near the end of the article about the fact that GALAX's mission will soon be coming to an end, unfortunately, mainly because of budgetary restrictions. We're having this conversation on February 2nd. As of right now, what's the current status of the mission?
GALAX is taking data. There are plans in place to actually transfer the operations of GALAX to a consortium of partners that will include potentially international partners. But the transfer of a NASA satellite operations to a different consortium has actually never been done before, and there are a number of issues that need to be worked out. So there is optimism that this will, in fact, be worked out, but it's not certainty. So for the moment, GALAX is taking images of the sky and exploring the plane of the galaxy, going where it has not imaged before, but the future is looking better, subject to working out these contractual arrangements.
That sounds a little bit more optimistic, actually, than what you had written in the article. So obviously, between the time the article went to press and now, that some things have changed.
Yes, there has been interest from the international community. I won't say in particular which countries, but there have been countries that have attempted to launch ultraviolet satellites, and which unfortunately failed at launch. And there are other countries which are developing their astronomical communities and may even become partners of the 30-meter telescope project and see this as an opportunity to develop further their communities. So there is a surprising amount of interest out there.
One of the things that really struck me as I was working with you on the article was the small size of the spacecraft. You know, we have a picture, and it's really, you know, neat to see that such a small spacecraft and telescope could make such important contributions to astronomy. Was this due to the fact that the ultraviolet part of the spectrum had not been previously explored to great depth, or was it due to some aspect of the GALAX design, or was it something else?
The combination of the wide field of view and the fact that there had never been a digital sky survey in the ultraviolet really made for, I mean, we're talking about the only imaging in the ultraviolet having previously been done on film or in very small areas of the sky by a space telescope. But the fact that there had never been a wide field survey and the depth that we've reached even surprised us, 23rd magnitude in our bands, that's deeper than the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, made it possible for a small telescope to make big discoveries.
And early on in the article, you discuss these living dinosaurs, the ultraviolet luminous galaxies, or the UVLGs. You mentioned that they are common at great distances, but not so much at closer distances. Are these likely to be the same fundamental types of galaxies, or could the very different ones be different kinds of objects than the nearby ones?
Well, it's an interesting question. When you look at what you can measure in terms of the mass from the velocity dispersion, that is, the velocities of the stars, the chemical abundances, the ultraviolet luminosity, even the outflows of gas, these galaxies look identical to Chuck Seidel's Lyman Break galaxy at redshift 3. That's what the papers by Hoops, Tim Heckman, you know, of our team, who's a real expert in the team, have asserted. However, there is one difference. The galaxies at high redshift appear to be living in what will become very massive halos, that is, you know, hundreds of millions of solar masses of dark matter that will eventually become rich clusters of galaxies. The objects that we're studying nearby, or shall we say relatively nearby, 2 billion versus 11 billion light years, appear to be more isolated and not living in environments which will turn into clusters of galaxies.
And I would assume, too, that this ultraviolet luminous phase is just a very short part of these galaxies' overall lifespans, especially these nearby ones that have been imaged by Hubble, and we show pictures of several of them in your article. What do you think these objects will evolve into? And could there be local galaxies that we know of that were once these UVLGs in the past but are no longer that type of galaxy.
At the rate these galaxies are forming stars, it would be very unlikely that they could just keep on doing this for even a billion years. When one looks at their appearances and the way and the motions of the stars, the likely thing that they would turn into would be an elliptical galaxy. Yet, blue elliptical galaxies are somewhat rare, though for a long time there have been these arguments about are there stellar populations in elliptical galaxies that are somewhat younger. As you know, most elliptical galaxies are thought to be as old as the oldest globular clusters in the galaxy. But there has been this controversy that there may be a frosting of young stars. The interesting thing is I don't know of any cases of billion-year-old elliptical galaxies. There's one galaxy, NGC 5102, that really looks like it could be a faded one of these, but it's a disk, and it's an S0. It's in the southern hemisphere, bright blue. It's visible in amateur telescopes. But, you know, I can't think offhand of any well-known rich clusters of galaxies or even ellipticals in the field that look like they were once these galaxies.
So I guess they are still somewhat of an enigma.
Yes, it's an inspiration, actually, to think hard about what the descendants of these galaxies would look like at the present epoch.
And another part of the article that I found very, very interesting, and which you describe as, quote, galaxy's most fundamental contribution, is this idea of an HR diagram for galaxies. You know, our graphic that you helped us create shows that there are basically two regions of the chart in visible light. You have this red sequence and blue cloud, but when you add the galaxy ultraviolet data to the mix, then there this third region emerges that you call the Green Valley. I mean, how surprising was this discovery that there's kind of this new region of this diagram?
You know, when we first saw this emerge, I think people on the team were interested in it, but this was beginning to come out at a time when people were looking at the Sloan samples a new way, and initially it wasn't appreciated that how important a contribution the near UV bandpass made to this color magnitude diagram. But as time went on, and we realized that suddenly there was a clear separation between the red sequence and blue sequence of galaxies, and that there was something in the middle, and that much of what was in the middle were active galactic nuclei. That means black holes shining because of gas falling into them. That great interest emerged, and you know, we're still in the midst of what is a rather spirited debate about what's happening with galaxies in that region.
And what do these Green Valley galaxies look like in visible light? I mean, are there any that are close enough that they might be familiar to amateur astronomers?
Yeah, actually, M31 is considered to be in the Green Valley. And it has star formation, but the star formation is not as vigorous, clearly, as it was in the past. If you look at M31 and M33, images of them, or just look at them through the telescope, you can see that M33 has got lots of H2 regions and it's very actively forming stars. There's M31, you know, all you have to do is look through the eyepiece and you see that your eye, immediately the impression is that you're dominated by the bulge in nuclear light, which is red. In the case of M31, we have evidence for a black hole, but it's not a black hole that's shining with emission lines because we don't see gas falling in there. The evidence for the black hole comes from the motions of the stars.
And you mentioned, too, in the article that these Green Valley galaxies might be galaxies that are in transition from the bluer sequence to the redder sequence. What insight does that give you and your fellow colleagues about galaxy evolution in general, and perhaps even the history of our own Milky Way galaxy?
Well, we know that over the last 10 billion years, there has been a general tendency for galaxies that are actively forming stars evolve to massive red galaxies on the red sequence that are relatively dead. And then with time, there is this general evolution of blue galaxies into red galaxies. And how this occurs exactly, it may be multiple mechanisms. One possibility is that two galaxies merge. A great deal of stars are formed in the gas-rich or wet merger, and this uses up the gas and the galaxy becomes red and more massive. Another possibility is that as after the Big Bang, there was mostly gas and very few formed stars. And over time, particularly around redshifts of 2 or a look back time of around 9 to 11 billion years, there was really a period when a lot of gas was forming into stars. And then since that time, especially since redshift of 1, about half the age of the universe, there has just been this general tendency to, as it were, run out of gas. Galaxy encounters that stimulate star formation, but a general tendency for more and more galaxies to live in dense environments with large numbers of red galaxies and fewer numbers of star-forming disk galaxies.
Now, you mentioned a few other discoveries. One of them is the Myra tail, which I know made fairly big news a couple years ago in the scientific media. And I would think that was a big surprise to your team. In these galaxy images, have any other stars been found to have similar tails?
Yes, there's an object called CW Leo, which has been written up, and it doesn't have a tail, but it looks kind of like an octopus. It has a bubble of gas that is slowly, so what is kind of making Myra's tail special is the star is losing a lot of mass, and it has a high motion through space. CW Leo is losing a lot of mass, but it isn't moving so fast. So you get an octopus instead of a comet.
You mentioned at the end of the article there's this ultraviolet burst from a star possibly being swallowed by a black hole. You mentioned that the fading of the burst matched nearly exactly the predictions of what we would see if a star was tidally shredded as it fell into a 100 million solar mass black hole. You know, and I'm reading that and I'm thinking, okay, I can buy that, but I'm also wondering, are there other possible interpretations for that UV burst? Like, how secure is it that that was in fact a black hole swallowing a star?
Well, you know, there's this issue of black hole transients from supermassive black holes ingesting stars has been with us for a number of years because some galaxies have shown transient features in their spectra where they appear to look like an AGN and then those features fade. It's a process that's predicted to happen because chaotic orbits will occasionally send stars into the nucleus. There's a particular range of mass of supermassive black holes where these are more observable and likely. I think it's generally accepted in this case because it's been a one-off incident in terms of the variability of this galaxy. That this is almost certainly what has happened. And there is no other kind of event that you can imagine that would have such a long decay time. For example, collisions of neutron stars or anything involving a flare like a gamma ray burst, these things are over in seconds. And this is something that was very bright, but it also happened over a long time, many weeks. And it followed an exponential decay that was consistent with the theoretical. Obviously, what we'd like to do is observe a lot of these and compare them and start to learn and then also eventually go and measure the masses of the black holes, perhaps using the motions of the stars.
Were there other contributions that Galax has made over the last decade or so that you feel are fairly important but there just wasn't room to include in the article?
Yes, indeed. First, what is happening now is that Galax is becoming an essential part of surveys that involve data from the Spitzer telescope and the Herschel telescope. So it is being used to study star formation in spiral galaxies, you know, where you can see the stars directly with galaxies, where are the stars forming but shrouded in gas, and the radiation is seen in the infrared. And there are really significant teams involving tens of astronomers working on these comparisons and understanding how star formation works in the disks of galaxies. Another area that is fascinating are the cases of elliptical galaxies where there are these low levels of star formation. There is one paper that I'm working on where we have taken images with a Hubble telescope, and you look at these galaxies that optically look like ellipticals, and you image them in the ultraviolet, and you see spiral arms, but very strange spiral arms and other wisps of emission that look like very massive stars. area has been in the study of star formation in general, of what kinds of galaxies account for the majority of star formation. These are, it really is almost an endless thing, hot stellar populations and globular clusters. There's just a paper submitted on all the globular clusters galaxies imaged, and the horizontal branch, that is the helium-burning stars detected by Galax. In fact, I would say that Galax's greatest period of discovery and impact on astronomy may well be ahead of it, because when you think of the resource of an all-sky survey that is then matched with other all-sky surveys, like the Wide Field Infrared Space Explorer, or WISE, that process is very, very labor-intensive, and it's only just beginning.
That answers the questions that I had, but was there anything else you'd like to add about Galax or the science or the mission that I haven't asked you about?
Well, yeah, I think that one concern is that Galax really has been exciting. It has provided a great resource, but there are no plans for a successor mission of any kind like this in the ultraviolet. In fact, once the Hubble Space Telescope ceases to operate, other than SWIFT, we won't really have an ultraviolet eye on the sky. There are plans for an 8-meter space telescope with ultraviolet capability. There's a project called AT-LAST, which would be an 8-meter space telescope, which could do ultraviolet imaging and would also have, as part of its mission, detecting and studying the atmospheres of Earth-like planets. So it would have a very precise mirror, but it could also do ultraviolet imaging. But so far as I know, it could well be 20 years or more before another satellite will survey the sky in the ultraviolet. One of the unfortunate things was that the far UV detector, which provided really spectacular science, ceased to operate about 2 years ago, and we were not able to survey the entire sky in the far ultraviolet. And in fact, we were not able to do many of the deep surveys we'd hoped to do in the far ultraviolet. Even if you were to launch a duplicate of Galax today and just set it loose, you would continue making an enormous number of discoveries just by virtue of doing a very deep survey using the far ultraviolet channel. But Galax's discovery space is enormous, and it would be wonderful to have a really good successor mission, and I just don't know when that's ever going to happen.
Well, I really want to tell you how much I appreciate taking the time to write the article and helping to provide the images and working with me, and then sharing your additional thoughts today with our readers. Thank you very much.
I want to thank you. This has been a great opportunity to bring forth some of our beautiful images and scientific explanation to the public, and it's something that everyone on our team, and I just wanted to mention, the article was written by me, but it represents the really extraordinary efforts of a great many people and the vision of Chris Martin, our PI. Chris had dreamed of this mission for 20 years. In many ways, it almost didn't occur. It has been his life's love and a great thing.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.